Hey, welcome to the Early Birds. Let's get started. Some things that I wanted to respond to that some of you have sent in, and I wanted to just initiate a discussion and an open mic about that. One was about voice, and other examples are just some thoughts about voice. And there are two or three that I want to, just passages that I'd like to read to you that, to me, illustrate voice. Because remember the example I gave of Anatoly Broyard from Intoxicated by My Illness, that you can listen to his voice, and in maybe one paragraph, you'll know more about the mind and soul of this man than many of your friends and acquaintances. So here's one more. Listen to the words and the experience you have in hearing them. My work, my life, is all with the sick, but the sick and their sickness drives me to thoughts which perhaps I might not otherwise have had, so much that I am compelled to ask with Nietzsche, as for sickness, are we not almost tempted to ask whether we could get along without it? And to see the questions it raises as fundamental in nature. Consistently, my patients drive me to questions. And consistently, my questions drive to patients. Thus, in the stories or studies which follows, there is a continual movement from one to the other. That's Oliver Sacks, the man who mistook his wife for a hat. Here's another. There are some things that human beings can see only out of the corner of their eye. The niftiest examples of this gift, familiar to all children, are small, faint stars. When you look straight at one such star, it vanishes. When you move your eyes to stare into the space nearby, it reappears. If you pick two faint stars side by side and focus on one of the pair, it disappears, and now you can see the other in the corner of your eye, and you can move your eyes back and forth, turning off the star in the center of your retina and switching the other one on. Something like this happens in music. You cannot really hear certain sequences of notes in a Bach fugue unless at the same time there are other notes being sounded, dominating the field. The real meaning in music comes from the tones only audible in the corner of the mind. That's from Lewis Thomas, Late Night Thoughts on Listening to Mahler's Ninth Symphony. Here's one more. When you write, lay out a line of words. The line of words is a miner's pick, a woodcarver's gouge, a surgeon's probe. You wield it, and it digs a path you follow. Soon you find yourself deep in new territory. Is it a dead end, or have you located the real subject? You will know tomorrow, or this time next year. You make the path boldly and follow it fearfully. You go where the path leads. At the end of the path, you find a box canyon. You hammer out reports, dispatch bulletins. That's Annie Dillard from The Writing Life. So these are all examples of voice, because it's a little hard to describe and elusive, but it's more about the experience you have as you listen and engage the words you hear from a person who you conjure in your mind, and it becomes a real person. There were a couple of questions I also wanted to ask to answer or respond to, at least. Some real-life examples of the craft of writing. We talked about that last time, and perhaps I didn't give enough case or illustration, but there are a couple that I wanted to just illustrate from people who I know quite well and know what they put into the craft of writing. A buddy of mine, Janine Roth, has written a number of New York Times bestsellers, number one bestsellers. A more recent book that was a bestseller is one called Lost and Found. It's her experience of being a Madoff victim from the financial scam. I didn't know this from her until she was a guest of mine on a mastermind group and describing what she does. She says, I never let any piece of writing from my office or from for anyone else to see, including my agent, until I have edited it a minimum of 30 times. Now, that to me is true dedication. Here's another perspective. A good friend of mine who has written a number of books, including New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestsellers, several years ago, I flew to Massachusetts to drive to a picturesque part of the state for his wedding. I'll, of course, take any excuse to visit my daughter and granddaughters in Boston, where she lives and practices. So at that time, he was writing a first thriller novel and shared some things with me. He spent 5 years writing it, including doing research by spending a few days on an aircraft carrier, lived on the aircraft carrier 24 hours a day, since his novel was set entirely on an aircraft carrier. His initial draft was 152,000 words. He hired a highly recommended writing consultant in the UK who sent him a 25-page single-space detailed review, and he spent the next months considering it, moving it to a second draft of 129,000 words, sent it to his agent. She read it, said it needed to be leaner, cleaner, tighter. He spent a few more months to get a third draft, which he called a positively anorexic 120,000 words. The agent nudged him to get it as close to 100,000 words as possible, with some suggestions and radical changes, eliminating some minor characters. He submitted draft 4, 103,000 words to his agent, and he got a 3-book deal. The first will be a filmed series. So this is some of the work that's needed behind the scenes to get to a place that you want to be. So I just wanted to let you know the role of perseverance and resilience to what it takes to get to where you want to go. So thanks for those suggestions and ideas. Anything else right now before we move into our topic of looking at the science, the neuroscience of writing, that might be helpful to discuss? Oh, one other thing. This, my friend, this is John David Mann. And he's written the 3 books. They began with Steel Fear, I think. They're 3 thrillers. The next one is set in Iceland, so guess what? He spent some time immersing himself in being in Iceland so he would get to know exactly what it's like to be there and write from that position of knowing. Someone asked him recently, so how does the whole writing thing work? Do you sit down and write when the inspiration strikes? His answer, no, I sit down and write when the alarm clock goes off. So, and he's right now he's doing something really different. He said, I'm in the earliest stages of working on 3 different book ideas, trying to nail down the core idea and the narrative spine of each one. So all 3 right now feel as elusive as wisp of smokes from a distant candle. He said, my job is to sit down every morning at 5 when the alarm goes off, pen and blank pad in hand, open my eyes and start looking. So even the very best of writers can get lost and still apply this principle of the structure and the stepwise process and the question we deal with many times each day in mentor coaching, what would you like to focus on first? So, thoughts, questions, any additions that you'd like to talk about or discuss yourself before we move into our topic. I welcome questions and comments. Thank you for sending those in, and I'm really ready to go with anything that will benefit all of us to discuss. So final call. Any thoughts or questions or additions? You guys know I'm going to ask you in, well, right now I'll ask you, did anybody buy cargo pants in the last week? But what I'm really seriously going to ask you at the end of our last seminar next week is, can you put in a sentence the most important thing you're taking away from this series? Know how we ask a client at the end of a coaching session, what's the most important thing you're taking away? Because the client then puts it in the output channel. They summarize and synthesize. It makes it more memorable, retrieval. It makes it more of a complete story. So that's helpful to do. And think about what that answer might be for you, because I'll reserve a bit of time at the end of our next seminar for that question. So anything now before we launch into our topic?
No, David, this is Bonita. Just the content is good, and most of it is just put it into practice. Just get it done. Take it out of the realm of thought and make it, start applying it. You know, just start applying the principles, getting disciplined, setting that alarm clock, and just doing it.
That's a great synopsis of that, because that is the summary of creating a system for your writing. Whatever your system is, and your system needs to be unique and specific to you, to take into account not only your biorhythms, but also the availability of time when you do this, what time of the day is best for more creative work, how you can work with the time you do for writing in a consistent, predictable way. All of those are very important aspects that each of you can create your own structure of what works best for you to do that. So that's terrific.
Absolutely.
You know, when I was practicing psychiatry and psychoanalysis for all those years, you know, people would say, "Well, when do you find time to write?" And I would very kindly say, I don't find time. I create time. I come from growing up on a farm, so on Saturday and Sunday, when my kids were still sleeping, I had 2, 3, 4 hours sometimes early to write, because as soon as they woke up, I was on the floor with them, or being ignored by them as adolescents, but I was totally theirs. But that time was really important to me, and it was just consistent. So I was there to be ignored by them, basically, for all of their adolescence, 20 years total. So those Saturdays and Sundays became very important to really create that time. So whatever works for you and your creative product.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that. Any other thoughts or comments? Okay, well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode, talk about the science of writing, and I'll reserve just a bit of time. I think we'll have some time at the end to have any questions or brief discussion. So to talk about the science, the neuroscience of writing, to write and publish your first book, you'll have to leave your comfort zone. A comfort zone is simply a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process initially, but once established, it resists change. So think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. An increase or decrease in room temperature, even a degree or two, signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and our brains both contribute to maintenance of our comfort zone. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it, when it's uncomfortable or limiting. we tend to repeat and use the default mode. And that's our brain's job description, is to hardwire things that we repeat. And we know the outcome when we repeat something. A comfort zone can be a repeated role you play in a relationship, a pattern repeated, like procrastinating about making needed lifestyle changes. It can take various forms. For example, bargaining with yourself about seriously writing or really completing your book within a specific time frame. In the beginning, departure from a comfort zone feels, by definition, uncomfortable. It's a rupture of continuity. You're breaking your script. The routine is broken. But remember, a habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated over and over. Remember this also with every client who takes one step of change. They will experience some discomfort because that's not their script. That's not their default mode. They take one step and create a change, even though it's temporary, it's basic, it still registers as discomfort. The error detection mechanism of the brain says, this is not what I expected. So it's important that you can empathically resonate with your client to help them understand that discomfort with change, to help them frame it as progress of being in new territory, a signpost of moving ahead, so that they don't misread it to say, well, my intuition's telling me this is not the right thing, or my gut says this is wrong. That would be a misread. So helping them understand that, and beginning with helping yourself understand that, to expect some discomfort. It's not a signal that you need to put your pen down and go to the mall. So this is something to expect. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Your performance, even, for example, the money you make, operates in a similar way. If people get more successful, they may feel vaguely uncomfortable, different. If you make more money than fits with your self-image, it cues an internal thermostat to return to the comfort zone. Here's an example of a comfort zone in action. Over 80% of lottery winners in the U.S. winning $3 million or more within 5 years file bankruptcy. Their money changed, but their mindset didn't. So a comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious. Then you can reprogram your mind and brain. Your mind can reframe, your brain can rewire. So the possibility here, for example, may be simply to make a habit of writing, to construct a schedule and be loyal to that schedule. It's a decision you only have to make once. You don't debate about it every day. You simply do it. Now, let's look at how we frame something. This is something really fundamental that we deal with in coaching. How you frame something determines the mindset you use to process it. How you frame something can change the meaning, and the meaning can change your mind. Meaning derives from the frame we place around an event or a situation. So think about how we do this in coaching. The client begins describing a problem. Now, if they pursue that problem, they'll go down a pathway that they are already familiar with. That's a comfort zone. And they know exactly what's going to happen, even though it may be limiting, there may be a glass ceiling, it may be frustrating, but they know the outcome. And predictability can read as effectiveness. So what we may want to do at that point is to interrupt them and say, what's the possibility here? Or is there an opportunity to look at? Because at that juncture, how you frame something determines the entire software package you use to process it. And looking at something in a new and different way begins to generate new neuronal connections and ways of processing things in your brain. It's not going to feel comfortable necessarily, but think of this as you began to define what you want to do in writing, how you create a system and a structure to do that. So every meaning and frame is yours to construct. It's not there until you create it. So your response, your perception of an experience and a meaning you attribute is a bridge between an external event and your internal state. So you define what that is. You define the mindset you use to boot up to deal with it. And that's how a frame can determine your state of mind. So the reticular activating system at the base of the brain decides what's allowed into consciousness out of all the millions of bits of stimuli and information that stream into the brain. For example, right now, focus on your feet. Pay attention just to your feet. Move your feet back and forth just a little bit on the floor. Notice how your feet feel as you wiggle your toes, as you move your feet back and forth on the floor. Now, your feet have been there all along, but you cue your reticular activating system to attend to your feet and get feedback. That's how we do selective attention. You'll pay attention to whatever fits your story, the framework you use. That's how, in coaching, we began to hear in the process of how someone presents how they construct their story. We hear their script. We can hear, and this is important in coaching. Now, as a sidebar, you never have to go into the past or ask why or go into the origins or the dynamics of the history. Every algorithm that is operative for your client, for what they think and feel and experience and process, you will see as it arises in the conversation with you. So this is an important aspect to cue your radar to listen to the process of how the client is showing you exactly what it's like to be them. That's how that 90 to 95% of the unconscious operating system manifests itself in the process of the work with you. Now, the key to this entire discussion on frame, now, you knew I had to be up to something other than talking about one of my favorite topics of mind-brain interaction. Your book outline is more than just your blueprint and your game plan for your book. It's your frame. When you start writing about something specific, you've constructed a book outline, examples begin to appear. It's as if the universe is conspiring to help you achieve your goal. Yellow Jeeps keep appearing. You can't get away from them. So I had a series of experiences in psychoanalysis that I've had more recently in mentor coaching. My patients then, who were therapists or psychiatrists or psychoanalysts in training and who were working with me either in supervision or as patients, would notice that as soon as they worked through an issue and came to terms with it, suddenly there were a half a dozen of their own patients that would bring up that issue. Now, their patients had been unconsciously taking a number, patiently waiting until it was their turn, and they had some sense that their therapist was now able to deal with it, so they brought it up. Now, those of you who have worked in professional coaching, think about how this has come about with your clients, and you're going to notice the same thing. They will wait for you to get your arms around something, to get your story straight, so you can help them, so you can help them with theirs. Now, as authors, you'll notice it again, and it will pertain to what you're writing. For example, many years ago, in the first few months after the release of my book, The Secret Language of Money, along with beginning a licensed specialty certified training program for financial coaches and professionals, my clients began giving me illustrations. People would write in from things I mentioned in my blog, the series based on the book. Their money stories were there at center stage, needing to be coached. It crystallized awareness. So here's what the law of attraction tells us. Whatever you focus on, you will both notice and participate in bringing about. So here's a three-step combination to reframe and incorporate this new endeavor. One, it may be visualization, especially if you're a visual person. You can create powerful and stimulating internal images. Visualization reprograms the reticular activating system by programming awareness. It cues your radar. Affirmations, the positive validation of doing and being what you want. Affirmations are the story that support your visualization. Your visualizations, when you repeat them, rewire your brain. The affirmations revise your mind software to support the stories that help you achieve those visualizations and plan for them. So to allow yourself to be creative, for example, you have to lose the fear of being wrong. Affirmations will provide a sense of safety and hope and frame exactly what you're creating. Secondly, change your behavior to exactly what you want. New behavior, new experiences create new pathways in the brain. And think about it. The essence of what we help our clients do is to break their script. If everybody corresponded to your script and did exactly what you wanted and hoped and would script for them, you think you'd be the happiest person in the world, but it will never work. And that's when we have clients who cannot get people to read the lines of the script that we have. So the usual behavior that's scripted is disrupted. So those pathways that get deeply etched with repetition suddenly are challenged. So that automatic behavior, the default mode, isn't working anymore. So that brings then the possibility of looking at what you do. And the third step is to create a plan and systematically go about that with that map. So just briefly, as an overview, the science of the vision is our brains can't tell whether you're actually imagining something as a success scenario of completing a goal that you want when you imagine all the components of that, or whether you're actually seeing it through your optic nerve. So the brain registers it in the same way. That's how it can be helpful to rewire your brain. We've discussed this before. So the important thing here is you do not make the brain change permanent unless you incorporate it into your story. This is the final step of change with any client, but beginning with yourself, to incorporate it as part of how and who you are, your working model of yourself. If you just generate change and don't incorporate it as part of the bedrock of your identity, you'll revert back to whatever happened before. The most powerful force of the human psyche is your identity. Whatever that identity is, you're going to return to. Now, if you evolve and transform your identity in new ways, now we're talking about writing and being an author, then that can foster the acquisition, the pursuit, and the realization of those goals. So here's the important aspect. When you incorporate it into your story, you make it permanent. A simple example, 95% of people who lose significant weight gain their weight back plus a pound or two or three. Why? They don't do this. They don't reprogram their body image. And they live then into that body image. And if it's where they were before, they're going to be exactly at the same weight. This is why you, as a writer, will need to reprogram your identity to incorporate that as an evolving sense of yourself. So envision the experience of your completed book, not of getting there, but of being there, of announcing the successful release, the entire experience of the completion. This is one way to incorporate your objective as part of your identity rather than it just seeming like a good idea. We know that by simply picturing a danger, we can trigger the entire body response of fight and flight. Now, while your unconscious mind can't tell the difference between something you physically see and something you mentally picture, your conscious mind can, and your conscious mind must incorporate an evolving story to assemble that imagery and your new self-concept as part of your new story. Otherwise, it either doesn't register or it's extruded as noise. So the key elements are repetition, so that the neural networks dedicated to your vision can be rewired and repeated regularly, so they're not eliminated. Secondly, conscious incorporation of this new vision into an ongoing story to be ultimately metabolized as part of your sense of self, so that you don't lose the vision, so it becomes part of who you are. And specificity about the experience of achieving this goal as you visualize it, because visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea, and the experience changes your brain. A vision can serve as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. Here's a really simple example. A couple of you heard this before, I know. Major James Nesbitt spent 7 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. During the time he was imprisoned, he was essentially isolated and had no physical activity, but he knew that he had to do something to structure his day, to basically not go crazy. Now, before the war, Major Nesbitt was an average weekend golfer. He had broken 100 on two occasions. He had two 99s. Everything else was in the triple digits. But he decided that every day, 7 days a week, he would get up, visualize putting on his golf clothes, driving to his favorite course, stretching, warming up, making every shot, walking to it, smelling, be engaged all the senses. So 7 days a week, he would spend 7 to 8 hours a day visualizing golf for all of the 7 years of his imprisonment. When he was released, the first time he played golf, he shot a 74. It's the power of the vision of mind over matters. Now, let's talk about a more immediate experience about the neuroscience of writing. And that's a state of mind. We enter and leave states of mind fluidly and invisibly, like a precision passage of the baton between relay team members. Each of us has a set of different states of mind: relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, focused attention. So a state of mind is basically a psychophysiological state. It's an internally organized software program that has expectations, attitudes, meanings, feelings. So each state of mind is like its own software program. So what you see when you see elite performance is the backstory of that elite performance is the deliberate practice of getting in a state of mind, developing those skills, the repetition, the growth mindset, so that that becomes automatic. And then the performance is in the same mindset, the execution of that skill. Now, this is essentially what can be very important for your writing. You sit down to write. I think it's really important to get in a state of mind to access the creative experiences and the synthesis and integration that you have. So it's not about inspiration. That's when suddenly something happens to boot up that state of mind. You don't feel any control over it, but it just happened and you better ride it while it's there. This is about creating that state each time you sit down to write. You get grounded and centered, and you access those states and that information. When you're grounded and centered, you have access to all of the information in all of your states of mind. So that can be really important to frame what you do when you sit down. So the regulation of feelings and states of mind involves, I think, understanding and mastery of access to those different states. Here are some examples of how artists and authors each enter a creative state to fit their intended work. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to entering the state of mind she needed to write her macabre literature. Dr. Samuel Johnson and the poet W.H. Auden maintained a continuous sense of stimulation by constantly consuming tea as they wrote. Willa Cather read the Bible to set up the right tone for her writing. George Sand immediately went from making love to writing. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. I'm giving you some multiple choices here, guys. Benjamin Franklin and one of my favorite authors, Diane Ackerman, both did the same thing, or do the same thing in Diane's case. They write in a warm bubble bath with a pine plank across the bathtub and write on that because it creates that warm, floaty feeling that is a creative one for them. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for a sail during an incredible storm, and he would later come back and recreate this experience on canvas. So this is how simple, and some authors simply play a piece of music repetitively during writing, but the corresponding state of mind in the reader often matches that of the author. The author guiding the reader to that state of mind through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of the imagery, the rhythm of feeling. So each of us has a continuum of states with some level of awareness about what state works best for what endeavor, and maybe even how to enter and exit different states. So I think that's really important, especially as you sit down to write, to know how to enter that state of mind and sustain it during that period of writing. So these are important aspects. Let me just give you a couple of examples about how to regulate states of mind. This is what we're really talking about. You'll find this valuable, I think, in working with clients, because this is one of the fundamental things that we help our clients do, to regulate states of mind and manage emotions for executive function. Now, think about this. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind without using other people or substances to do that. So using drugs or alcohol or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotion can lead to significant compromise. Your your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. Now, there are a couple of primary ways to regulate your state of mind, and this is where I'm suggesting to listen to the 30-35 minute free webinar at the very bottom, the very last link on the homepage of MentorPath. It's called Master States of Mind. There are a couple of examples there and a couple of case studies, one of which is how I began to think about developing a systematic way to do this. So the basic ways to regulate a state of mind are physiology and focus. Physiology, like a deep breath and focusing on breathing, and the focus to sustain that and regulate a state of mind. So think about what works best for you. And a model for what we do as coaches in focusing just on our client, helping them develop their story, or when you sit down to write, focusing on what you do, is mindfulness meditation. When you focus just on your breathing and the breathing in of relaxation, breathing out of any tension, if you happen to have a thought, which you will because that's your brain's job description, is to activate and stimulate you, let it go. Refocus on your breathing. So this focus and sustaining the focus and letting go of the things that might otherwise distract you to restore your focus and sustain your immersion in that creation or whatever it is you've decided to do, that can be a kind of microsystem to help you focus in that way. So those can be important aspects. An example that I gave, I'm pretty sure I included this in the Master States of Mind, so it may be a little redundant if you listen to it. But this is an example of regulating states of mind and the importance of what you do in performance with that. Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, arrived, and his team, when he was hired as head coach, was ranked 217 out of 217 teams in their division nationwide in free shot percentage, lowest, obviously, in their division. So during practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra when they practiced free throws. He suggested a three-part mantra, a cue, for example, dribbling the ball twice, a focus phrase such as relaxed and smooth, and a physiology such as a deep breath to breathe in relaxation and breathe out tension. So in 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 seconds, they would dribble, take a deep breath, have a focus phrase, and then shoot. And this did not slow them down, but they did it automatically. And additionally, he would blow the whistle during practice, have them go to the free shot line, and shoot 2 free throws. Because, you know, in a real game, you have to shoot when you're fouled, when you're on tilt, when there's some kind of a... So he simulated the actual conditions. And when they made both, they got to take a break. When they did 4 laps. In 2 years, their team was number one in their division nationwide in free shot percentage. So this fundamental three-step process, the mantra, the cue, and that may be simply, I think I gave the example in the webinar that I'm mentioning, like before I do a keynote, I would put my index finger and thumb together on both hands and touch them in the middle to make a little infinity sign because I don't carry a basketball to a keynote. And that, while I'm using a focus phrase like relaxed and powerful, can be very helpful to get me in exactly the state of mind in 3 or 4 or 5 seconds to do that keynote. So those are important things. I know some of this is redundant from what we've talked about earlier, but I just want to mention again the importance of regulating state of mind and having your state match what you're doing. If you're writing creatively, that's one state, one whole software package. If you're editing, that's a different part of your brain. Don't mix the two and go back and forth. So these are just some things to find out what works for you and what will be your best practice for doing this. So here are some things that interfere with the creative process. Obstacles to become aware of in order to avoid. Every one of these we could also call, from a coaching perspective, limiting assumptions. You know, we usually think of limiting assumptions when we listen to a client saying, well, you know, I need to be comfortable to really start this, or I need to be confident. So we know those are not preconditioned. We know those are limiting assumptions that are result from someone stopping themselves and stopping the anxiety. Waiting until it's the right time. Waiting until you have something that you really want to say. Waiting until you have enough money to justify the time. Telling yourself it's too late. Being afraid of what family or friends might think. Thinking that an appointment with yourself for creative time is an indulgence or a luxury. When you solve a problem, neurotransmitters immediately respond with a rewarding release. So your most powerful way to write effectively is to facilitate insight to create a situation that gives you a novel approach. Schedule, protect, preserve the space for your creativity to live, to unfold. You establish the crucible for this creative force when you set aside time and provide an environment free of intrusions or distractions. So here's one exercise. Morning pages. Now, I stole this idea, but I want to pass it on to you. Julia Cameron, in The Artist's Way, describes morning pages as a way to foster creativity initially. Morning pages, as she describes it, 3 pages of longhand writing done first thing in the morning, totally stream of consciousness. She emphasizes there's no wrong way to do this. Just write. Even if you can't think of anything to write, write anyhow. Don't edit or judge. Just write. Don't even engage that part of your brain that judges or edits. The morning pages are a primary tool for initiating or even rediscovering your creativity. You begin with a free flow of associations for 3 pages worth. That can affect the rest of your day. Now, here's an example, an application of flow, of how insight changes the brain. fMRI monitoring the brain reveals that at a moment of insight, an aha moment, a new set of neural connections are created. Any aha experience, a moment of insight, lights up 3 different parts of your brain. And that activation instantly vaults you into a state of mind that is more creative and synthetic and integrative. Now, contrast this. An fMRI, same brain, given information, data, facts, commands, no part of the brain lights up. Nothing happens. This is an important aspect because your creative experience will be self-perpetuating, and it will be something that you'll want to do and immerse yourself in the process and sustain that immersion. Now, things like writer's block or things like that are all about state of mind. If you're in a state where you can't access that creative or haven't accessed that creative experience and that state of mind, you feel blocked. So this is a way to prevent blocks and to have a systematic way to enter a state of creativity. So here's a summary, then, of the science of writing. And I'll tell you about maybe some different applications of this if we have time and if you're interested. Here's a summary of the science of writing. Since old patterns are hardwired, consistency of focus on new experiences is what it takes to change this wiring. But you have to tolerate discomfort at the beginning. Concentrate on new behaviors, possibilities rather than problems or obstacles in order to create new brain pathways. Identifying a problem won't solve it. This is what we do with our clients to help them frame possibility, opportunity, and create new pathways rather than going down the same pathway of the problem, because it's just going to etch that pathway further, which is why some people get stuck in therapy, as we've talked before. Create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits with an eye on the prize. The completed book, for example, to lay new mental maps. Regulate states of mind and manage emotions to begin each writing session. New insights and adaptation occur through balanced learning, left brain and right brain, intellectual and emotional. When you're grounded and centered, you have access to all the information and all the ways of synthesis and decision making in your brain during that time. It's not either or. When you're diverted, not if, but when, because you will be diverted into an old feeling or behavior, redirect ideas and energy flow back to the new ideas, back to the framework of your story of creative immersion in writing. The discipline and work of writing and rewriting and ultimately your complete book. Remember that the power is in the focus, and that permanent change comes from the consistency of that focus. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. Focus aligns and directs energy and efforts. Remember, from neuroscience and from quantum physics, we get what we focus on, not what we want. Emphasize positive adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Reframe. Knowledge is inert until it's activated. Put it into behavior. Think about your new experience and your evolving self. How your new experience will evolve a transformation of your identity. No longer the old story. I'm an author. So I want to close with some inverse wisdom for authors. So what follows are the highlights of the introduction to Outsmart Your Brain, an instruction manual. But this is specifically adapted for authors. I came home from college after my freshman year and announced to my mom that I decided to major in psychology. We talked. She was excited for me. Then she mentioned that she'd made an A in her college psychology course. I had no idea that she ever took psychology. I said, oh, I didn't know that. You must have really enjoyed it and studied a lot. She said, no. You'd have to know my mom. No, I just answered everything on the tests the opposite of what I thought was right. And I was stunned, but it totally made sense to me. So here's a list of 9 things that are the inverse of conventional wisdom for authors. In honor of my mom, who thought it was all opposite anyway. 1, burn your bridges. Make it impossible to go back to an old habit or way of being. If you decide to quit postponing the completion of your book, make it impossible to go back to postponing it. create an uncomfortable scenario if you should slip back. Focus on the present without the rewarding beliefs. Reward yourself for proceeding and not going back. Even if you think you have writer's block, you don't get to go to the mall during your writing time. 2, do the opposite of what you normally do when you're afraid, worried, or anxious. Remember one of the Seinfeld episodes, George Costanza thought that he was a loser and failed at everything. He would just do the opposite of what he usually did. If you're uncomfortable with public speaking, avoidance will increase the fear, so do more of it. Whatever you're afraid, worried, anxious, uncomfortable, or stuck about, do the opposite. Embrace it. Join Toastmasters. You have to jump in the water because you can't learn to swim on paper. 3, obstacles reveal desires. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. So instead of figuring out a way to sidestep or overcome or go around an obstacle, consider simply not creating it. It's not there until you create it anyhow. When you're ready to recognize that you create an obstacle, you're ready to recognize the possibility of not creating it. That's also going to be useful in your coaching. 4, discomfort can be a sign of progress. Moving beyond your comfort zone is necessary for progress. Comfortable is not a place you begin. It's a place you can arrive. Moving from a comfort zone is necessary in order to proceed. 5, lean into the unknown. If you wonder whether you can write and sell a book because you've never done it before, lean into the action of doing it. If you think you're too old to do something, you'll be right. You can tiptoe through life very carefully and arrive safely at death. 6, don't believe every thought you have. I'll never be able to write a book. Thoughts lie a lot. They're like my Uncle Ted, God rest his soul, or I'd have to use another example. You don't have to believe every thought that crosses your mind. You're not even stuck with the brain you have. You can make it better. Remember Vincent van Gogh's sage advice. If you hear a voice saying, I'm not a painter, then by all means paint, and that voice will be silenced. 7, you do not attract what you want. You create what you focus on. Cue your radar for early recognition. Keep an eye open for yellow jeeps, stories, illustrations for your book, opportunities to talk about what you're writing about. A caveat, talk about your subject, not the book you're writing. Talking about writing your book can dissipate the energy of its writing. How many people do you know who have a book in them? Or, I've been working on a book for the last decade. 8, you only see what you believe. I'm going to say that again. Some things have to be believed in order to be seen. And when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. This fact comes from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks. In quantum mechanics, as well as in the brain, the question you ask influences the outcome you see. A well-verified law is called the quantum Zeno effect. Zeno, the mental act of attention activates and holds in place brain circuitry. Consistent focus then rewires the brain. Use this principle to help you write your book. You'll begin to see more of what you want to write about. And finally, 9, believe in someone and he or she will show you why you do. Neuroscience has demonstrated that authentic belief in someone activates the other person's brain to create a state of mind that then transcends usual thinking and performance. I think that's huge. That person could be you, the author. Well, we have far less time than I had hoped to discuss, but I'm eager to hear any thoughts or questions or things you'd like to discuss a bit more about. Anything that you're taking away from this seminar that you think will be valuable to you in your writing? One at a time,
Danny,
now. Go ahead, please.
Danny Bedoni, how are you?
Welcome.
So,
hey, how are you, Danny? Great.
Nice to hear you. So when you say focus on the character and not on the book, how is that so? Because I'm focusing on the book and all the characters that are coming in. How do I just focus on the character? What does that mean?
I'm not sure what you're referring to. I didn't emphasize just focusing on the character. I've focused on the process and the structure and the system of writing to be able to get in that flow and have nothing interfere with it, and with that structure then to emphasize beginning that process each time by getting in state, so that you get in a state of mind that will foster the creative thinking and the synthesis and integration of all that you know to what you focus on. So it's the focus and the state of mind that I think can be most productive. Tell me if that's not answering your question, and if it's
that
something
is
else.
Perfect. No, it's perfect. Thank you.
Okay.
The focus. I got it. Thanks so much.
All right. Great. Thanks. Other thoughts or questions, just quickly, that we could talk about that might be helpful. Remember, if you can, to write down an important thing that you're taking away, because I think it will be interesting for each of us to hear some of those important takeaways at the end of our next seminar. We're going to talk about the business of writing, but I will definitely allow time or create some time at the end to do that, so that we can have an exchange of the things that you take away, because that's how we create closure and memories of what we do and make it even more accessible. So thanks very much for attending. Thanks for the correspondence and the things you've sent in. I welcome that, and I look forward to picking up right here for our final seminar next week. Take good care of yourself. Thanks very, very much. See you guys. Bye now.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank you.